Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, May 23rd, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week by doing all of the great things that you do to support the show, by rating and reviewing on iTunes, by sharing on social media like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and even by telling your friends about the show or by, you know, shooting me some tweets, some comments, some questions. I really love to interact with you guys in that way. I also want to thank those of you who stopped by the website this week, KaraSantaMaria.com, who shopped in the Talk Nerdy store. All of those proceeds obviously support the podcast. And those of you who supported via PayPal and Patreon. Remember, if you want to show your support, you can go to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge any amount that you would like on a per episode basis. This week, the show's big supporters are Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Charles Payet, Jafe, The Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Remember, guys, Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download. It will always remain that way, and it is because of support from listeners like you. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart. All right, I'm really excited about this week's episode. I had a chance to have a remote chat with a fascinating human being who also happens to have one of the coolest jobs in the world. She's the director of outreach for the astronomy department at Columbia University. Here she is, Summer Ash. Summer, thank you so much for taking the time to join me all the way from New York City.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be joining you today.
I am really excited too. I know it's a lot later for you, obviously, because you're 3 hours ahead of me. Middle of the day Sunday for me recording. What's it like in New York today? Because it's gorgeous in LA.
It wasn't too bad. It was kind of, you know, 70, but not sunny. We've had a lot of clouds come in, which is such a bummer because actually tonight, tomorrow, and Monday are supposed to be fantastic for getting the moon and Saturn and Mars all together in the sky.
You know, last night I pulled out the telescope for the first time. So I have this new Celestron telescope I'm super excited about. It's, what's it called? A Nexstar Evolution 8. And I've only used it so far, like with my friends and with people who know how to use it. And so last night I pulled it out for the first time. And of course, like I had to troubleshoot everything. Like everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Like aligning. And then I realized like I had the cap still on the star sense, but not on the main telescope. And it's like, oh, of course, the star sense can't see. And then I finally got it aligned, but then I couldn't pull focus on anything. And I didn't know why. I was like, oh, I'm so much better at microscopy than, what do you call it? Telescopy? No, probably not.
That's really hilarious. I've never thought of what the opposite of microscopy is. Telescopic.
Telescopy.
But you're right. Telescopy. Who knows?
But finally, I was texting with my friend. He was like, focus on the horizon and then you can come up and go to the moon. And finally I did. And I'll tell you what, last night, the moon was gorgeous. Mars was right there, bright as can be. I could even see like a little bit of surface features on Mars. Jupiter looked incredible. It was really exciting.
Oh my gosh, I'm so jealous. So yesterday was a full moon and Mars is going to be at its closest point on the 30th, I think, of May.
So it's pretty close now.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're like
so it's
right next to each other in the sky.
Yeah. And you know what? After we had a conversation last when you were here about your telescope, I literally today was shopping online.
Yes. That's amazing.
I'm about to pull the trigger.
Yeah. So I was just in New York for the Nexus conference. That's the Northeastern Conference on Science and Skepticism with the Skeptics Guide guys, my fellow rogues. And while I was there, you and I got to have dinner, which was really fun, and catch up because I hadn't seen you since SciComm camp this past November.
Right. Which was over 6 months ago.
That's crazy. And so I got to get a little bit filled in on all the cool stuff that you do with your job, but I would love to talk about it on the podcast because I feel like a lot of people listening would love to hear about what you do over at Columbia.
Oh, sure. That's very flattering to hear. So at Columbia, I'm the director of outreach for the astronomy department. And our department is somewhat unique in this because There's several other departments that try and do public programs, but we're one of the few that has a dedicated person, which is me, to set up and run these programs. So I'm actually employed to design and staff, advertise, run, commission new ideas for all these kind of ways to engage the public, both the general public, school kids, teachers, all sorts of crowds. We like to try and engage as many different demographics as possible. And then the grad students are basically all of my volunteers who help out. And so it's part of the culture in the department, which I think is really fantastic because they all get a chance to both, you know, organize events, engage with the public, practice explaining their science, get, you know, proficient at operating the telescopes, all that stuff.
That's cool. So when you say that you head up outreach, like you're not talking about writing press releases for the department. You're talking about actually engaging with like citizen scientists and like children and adults in the community and getting them excited about the astronomy that's happening at Columbia.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, our program, we don't exactly have like a mission statement for the outreach, but I think it's to both engage in the public and get the public excited about astronomy and science, but then also communicate the science that's being done in our department. And then also just really get people to realize that you can look up even in the middle of New York City and see the night sky and you can see recognizable objects. And then you can come see them with us and you can get even more information about what you're seeing, why it looks the way it does, how else you can see it. And then you can pester one of the grad students with all your questions about how far away it is and how big it is and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, when I was there right after we finished dinner, and it wasn't a really clear night. There was a little bit of cloud cover, but there were breaks in the clouds. We looked up and we could see the moon, Mars, and Jupiter like plain as day.
Yeah,
that was awesome.
I think it's understandable that in some parts of the city people don't look up because they're surrounded by really tall buildings. But at the same time, I think people just forget that they can see stuff. And so everyone comes to Columbia and they're so surprised that they could see all of this. And I always tell them, you know, as long as you're not in Times Square, you should try and see it anywhere else you are in the city, because you'll be surprised that you can still see it with your naked eye.
And so when you do these outreach events, specifically when you're doing events surrounding stargazing, looking through telescopes, even looking up with the naked eye, you do them in the city?
Yeah, everything we do is in the city. So for our big major program is a public lecture and stargazing series that we have almost twice a month during the academic year. And the stargazing takes place on the roof of the building that we're in, which is Pupin Hall. It's the physics, astronomy, and astrophysics building. So we have two installed domes with telescopes in them on the roof. And then we also have a handful of portable telescopes. So on a really, on a good clear night, we'll have four different telescopes pointed at four different targets on the roof for people to look through.
That's so cool. And so how, let's say that I live in New York and I'm listening to this podcast, I'm like, I want to go. Like, what do I do?
So our website, what's easiest actually is if you just look up Columbia Astronomy Stargazing. But the program, the official name is just Columbia Astronomy Public Outreach. And we have a website that lists our calendar for our different programs for these major public ones. So it changes every semester. We have a new program. And then we also have a summer series as well. In the summer, because the sun sets so late, we actually switch and we do science fiction films. And then we have a little discussion afterwards, sort of science fiction versus science fact. But then we still have a little bit of observing afterwards. We don't go to the roof as much because we try to do some maintenance in the summer.
Yeah, that makes sense. I have to say, you have the coolest job.
It's pretty fun. I really like it. I think what I like best, besides the fact that it's space and I'm already like obsessed with space, so just getting to do space for my job is great. But I love going between different audiences. So you have to figure out, you talk about things differently with different age groups, different academic backgrounds, different sizes of audiences, things like that. And I find that really fun and challenging to customize the message to the audience.
So what did you study in school to do what you now do? Are you personally an astronomer who now does outreach in astronomy? Are you somebody who studied like communications and then you found your love for stargazing? How'd you get to where you are?
So I kind of, I always like to tell people I took the, like a long winding road approach, but it was always in the direction of space. But I'm both an engineer and a astrophysicist, so to speak. But that's kind of semantics based on the department that you end up going to for grad school. But I started off in mechanical engineering for undergrad. So that's my bachelor's degree. And I worked in aerospace for several years because I really liked the tangibleness of engineering, building things, swaying things, designing things.
Well, and also the fact that you can get a job with a bachelor's degree. That's always
that wonderful. Definitely is a plus, right?
Yeah, exactly. Not always the case with science.
No, that's a really good point. But I kind of felt the pull of school. At first, I thought I might want to go back and do planetary science because that almost felt like it was bridging the gap between space and tangibleness, because geology felt very intuitive to me, forces and things like that. So that really struck me as interesting. But during I went to this crazy school that not everyone knows about, and so it sounds like it's completely fake, but it's called the International Space University.
No, you didn't. That's amazing.
It's a real place. It's a very magical place. Because it was one of the best years of my life. It was a very transformative year. But they expose you to the entire space industry. So you really get you get lectures and you do projects in space law and business and marketing and launch vehicles and space satellite design and life sciences in space. And you talk to cosmonauts and astronauts. And so it's really, really, really broad. But as part of that experience, I got to do a 3-month internship in astronomy. And that's what sort of convinced me. I said, I want to go where there's telescopes. So I got to go to the University of Hawaii for 3 months, and I helped a postdoc there. We'd go over to the Big Island and use the telescopes to look at Kuiper Belt objects, actually, and occasionally
that's
a comet
so cool.
or two. And that kind of sealed the deal where I was like, okay, yeah, I want to study what's out there.
So I did go
to grad school. I did not finish because I found my love for education and outreach while I was doing that. But I did 5 years of radio astronomy in the astrophysics group at Cambridge University.
Holy shit, you did 5 years before you left?
I did.
So you've been at Columbia 8 years. 5 of those years you were directing outreach for astronomy, but you had a pretty big health scare right in the mix of that, didn't you?
Yeah, actually, I started the outreach August of 2011, and July of 2012, I had open heart surgery.
Wow. And so was this, you had mentioned that when you were at Cambridge, so, you know, you were dealing with some mental health issues like around depression, being far away, struggling with, you know, whether or not you wanted to continue with your degree. You also mentioned that there were some health issues there. Did you know about the heart problems leading up to that?
No, actually, I knew when I was 19, I was told that I had a heart murmur. But nobody told me that it could be associated with something that needed monitoring. So
I don't even know what that is. What, I mean, you hear people have a heart murmur.
Yeah.
It means your heart makes noise.
Yeah. I think my understanding of it is that the valves in your heart, the ones that are both between the ventricles and the atria, and also the ones between the, can't remember which one finally pumps out to the aorta, but also that,
the
aortic valve.
The left ventricle,
the left
right?
Ventricle,
oh, okay.
Right? So that's
going out to there.
That's the aortic valve. So if they all close exactly the way that they're designed, there's probably like some baseline characteristic noise of your heartbeat and the valves closing that doctors are trained on. But then if any of the valves are shaped differently, are closing differently, like they all make their own noises, and doctors get trained like how to listen to the heartbeat and pick out like, oh, this valve's doing this, this one's leaking, this one's got this going on.
Gotcha. So there's a characteristic kind of snapping shut noise that they know what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And if anything's off, like a murmur is kind of a catch-all diagnosis of like something's off, whether it's leaking, whether it's not closing fast enough, whether there's a little jitter, like it doesn't sound right.
Exactly. Yeah. So I knew that I had a murmur and I went and got an echocardiogram for them to look at it closer. But basically they didn't, nobody ever like gave me a full debrief. They just said, it's benign. And I was like, okay, I like that word. Sounds good.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, okay, I just have a slightly different heart. That's fine.
Yeah. And so then it was another sort of one of those chain of events that just, my mom had gotten sick and had cardiac side effects to her medicine that she had been given. So I was with her in the hospital when I met her cardiologist, who was just a really cool woman. And it just popped into my head. I was like, hey, can you tell me more about my murmur? And she was like, sure, make an appointment, et cetera, et cetera. And that was January of 2012. And in March of 2012, she sent me an email saying, don't panic, but I think you should see a heart surgeon.
Wow. And this was probably, you never would have known if you hadn't proactively asked about it.
Yeah, that's the scary part, because when I had the surgery, it was not emergency surgery, but my surgeon had basically said in the next year or two, he's like, I can't really narrow it down, but you know, this will be a threat to your life. So Jeez. If you can clear your schedule sooner rather than later.
Sure. I mean, obviously you want to kind of preemptively solve the problem before it becomes something where you're collapsing in a locker room and you don't know why. What happened? Like, what was her diagnosis? Why did you have the heart murmur?
Oh, yeah. So what happened is I have a birth defect, congenital birth defect. My heart, my aortic valve has two flaps instead of three. So it's a bicuspid instead of a tricuspid.
Okay.
And that means the general course of somebody in living with that means that it calcifies faster over your lifetime, which means that it stiffens, which means that you like have less endurance, and you is something that you definitely notice. That was not the case with me, which was very bizarre, because it also means that when your aorta first forms, the cells that form the valve and the first part of the aorta come from the same embryonic tissue, and that whatever that defect is in the genes also produces less elastin protein in my aorta, so it's more prone to stretching out as well.
Gotcha. And like you were saying, the hardening of the arteries, that kind of happens for everybody with age.
Right.
It happens quicker for people with this defect.
Yeah. So I like to say that my aorta is a hipster because it's stretched out before it's cool to do so. And that's what happened. So my valve was not calcified or stiffened, but my aorta was already ballooning out into an aneurysm. And so it was 5 inches in diameter when it should have been roughly 2. Sorry, not inches. Goodness, there's not enough room in my body. Yeah.
Centimeters.
But still.
No, but that's so, yeah. It was more than twice the diameter that it should have been.
Yep.
So this is something where early on when you were young, probably it hadn't stretched out quite as much. Doctors listened. They didn't think that it was a big risk. Then when you actually went in and got like a Doppler or like some sort of way to visualize your heart, your cardiologist was like, you can't live like this.
Exactly, because the closer it gets, 5 is usually the bottom range for surgery. And anything above that, the danger is that it will rupture and you will bleed out internally. Because if the aorta goes, you almost have to be already next to the OR for them to have a chance at saving you.
Yeah, that is the artery with the largest blood volume in your entire body, I think.
Yeah, and the crazy part is that the aortic aneurysm itself is asymptomatic. So I was experiencing any symptoms. I was completely oblivious to what was happening inside me.
I like how you've clarified a little bit this conversation about aneurysm. And granted, like, I'm not a physician by any stretch of the imagination. I taught college A&P, but I don't think that really qualifies me. But I do think it's interesting how that term is used incorrectly. A lot of times, like, people talk about having an aneurysm, like, oh, he's going to go have an aneurysm and die, which they all, it's almost like they're mixing it up with the term embolism, I think. That's an aneurysm really is a morphological defect. It's a ballooning, it's a weakening of the wall of a vessel and like a ballooning out. And an aneurysm can rupture. I think that's what people are referring to when they say like so-and-so had an aneurysm.
Exactly.
Ruptured aneurysm. But lots of times you can walk around with an aneurysm for years.
Yeah. And that was something that that was one of the very first things I learned, because my first question was, isn't an aneurysm something that blows? And they're like, no, it's the stretching out. It's the ballooning.
It can blow. Yeah. And then you're talking, if it's in your brain, stroke territory, if it's in your heart, I don't even know what that's called. I guess it's an ischemic
event. I don't know if
it
can happen in your heart.
Yeah. Or I mean in your aorta, sorry.
But yeah,
your aorta, around your heart.
They can happen. So you can have, mine was my ascending aortic root, they call it. So it's the part of the aorta that comes straight out of the heart and before it turns into the arch. Where the other arteries branch off. But you can also have an aneurysm and consequently a rupture of the descending aorta, which is kind of like when it's going down towards behind your organs or, you know, through your organs in your torso.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sometimes you can feel your pulse there when you're exercising or something. You'll feel your pulse kind of in your belly, and that's that continuation there. You know, I'm interested, okay, as somebody who was prior to this struggling with some mental health issues, with depression, not sure about anxiety, oftentimes we see those things going in hand, and then you're learning that you have this congenital heart defect, you're learning that, you know, you need to do something about it now so that it's not an issue in the future, and thank goodness you were able to correct it. How much did anxiety play into this experience? I ask that only because I'm not even a very anxious person, but like I remember back when I used to smoke weed, I had to quit because I would start getting really, like I smoked weed for a really long time. But one thing that happened to me towards the end when I finally quit smoking weed was that it made me anxious in a way that's kind of hard to put my finger on. But one of the things I would always tell people is when I get high, I feel acutely aware of my circulatory system and it freaks me out to no end. There's something odd, I think, about our personal relationship, specifically with our heart, but especially with our internal organs, those kind of mystical things that give us life and that we don't access very often, that we can't really feel, but that do kind of carry a layer of both mystique and kind of fear around them. What was that experience like for you when you first learned, oh, there's something wrong, and there's something wrong with like a core part of who I am?
Yeah, that's a great question. So interestingly enough, I approached the entire situation as a scientist. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I realize I think that was completely a coping mechanism. I just sort of went into planning mode. And I think part of that might have just been influenced by within the past 6 months from finding out I needed surgery, I had been on my godmother's care team, and she had passed away from pancreatic cancer. So I had sort of seen what was needed and necessary in a medical and a hospital situation. Mm-hmm. So I think I immediately tried to approach it like, what will I need for my time in the hospital and my medical situation? And I want to put this all in place because also I'm type A personality. I'm a good organizer and I'm a scientist. So I really went at it first from that standpoint. And then I wanted to just know everything. I wanted to know why do I have an aneurysm? Like all the things we talked about already are things that I learned in the process of talking to my surgeon before surgery, saying, you know, why do I have this? Why is it this big? What's the danger of it? Why me? Why isn't it calcified? What are you going to do for the surgery? How does the surgery work?
And what did they do for the surgery, by the way?
So, well, there's a whole different conversation we can have about why my surgery was the way it was, but I got a full sternotomy. So that means
the hell is that?
That means they cut all the way through the full sternum.
Holy shit. Do they they cut straight down the middle of the sternum, sternum, or do they remove the sternum?
And no, they kind cut of open straight the down the middle.
What?
And then put this retractor in and they open it up. I basically had this 5-inch separation.
So your ribs are literally like pushing out to the outside, and there's just a big cavity in the middle, and they can reach their hands down inside your body. I'm freaking out right now.
Yep.
This is incredibly fascinating. But gosh, you must have been scared when you found out they have to do that.
No, that's the thing, is that I honestly think that I was keeping the fear aside.
It has to have been there. You must have just been sublimating it.
Oh, no, it is. Because I can tell the second part, half of the story happens like in year two.
Okay.
Yeah. For those, the leading up to surgery, it was all science all the time.
Gotcha. You were trying to be cool as a cucumber. Like, I am my own patient. I will learn everything.
Yeah. And also, I think I was also using that as a way to, I was using it to do science communication because I was explaining, I started a blog for friends and family to keep them updated. But I also wanted to be able to explain to them why, what was happening, why it was happening, and how it was going to proceed. Mm-hmm. So they actually cut out 4 inches of my aorta from the valve to where the other arteries come off of the arch. And they basically replaced it with a synthetic tube. So it's Dacron.
So it wasn't just that they removed the weak portion. They actually kind of removed at a clean break a length of your aorta and replaced it with basically a fake aorta.
Yeah, but I think the aneurysm itself is not, you know, was more than an inch of my aorta anyway. So I think it was a significant portion of that root.
Wow.
And then they just, you know, reattach it both sides. And then they put sternum wires in and they pull your sternum back together and they like wire it almost like metallic twist ties. And then they sew you back up and say you're good to go.
No. And so wait, the wire stays for forever or does it like dissolve?
Yep. Nope. They stay. They're steel.
So you have like a bear cage in your chest?
Yep.
That is crazy cool. You're like bionic. When you go to the airport, do you set off the metal detector?
No, that was one of my first questions, actually, was will my sternum wires set off the detector? And they don't. They do not, which is good because that would just be a whole other headache for traveling.
Yeah, that's true. Like it seems cool for a minute. You're like, yeah. But then you're like, wait a minute. That's not fun.
Yeah. But so all the science stuff, you know, that played a role. But then literally from the second I woke up in the ICU, I realized that all of that science stuff did nothing to prepare me for the actual experience of heart surgery.
Yeah.
My first thought was, can I cuss on this podcast?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. My first thought was, fuck.
Yeah.
Because the pain was so intense.
I don't think anybody, like, how are you prepared for your ribs getting cracked open, your sternum being cut all the way down itself lengthwise? Like nobody knows what that would feel like. It's a part of your body you don't access.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of it was also, I'd never had any major surgery. I'd had migraines, but you know, no pain like this before. And I think I just assumed that waking up in the ICU, my pain would already be in a managed situation.
Yeah.
But it was a shock to the system.
Oof. And did they just immediately give you pain medication? Like, were you able to get to a place that was managed, or were you kind of pushing that boundary the whole time you were in recovery?
I was pushing that boundary the whole time I was in the ICU for the first 24, maybe 36 hours, because they actually mismanaged my pain, and it was horrific.
Oh, no.
We just got behind the pain curve, and they just could not catch up. So it was a nightmare.
I wonder how common that is for patients.
I really hope it's not common because it was horrific and it was painful for me to go through and it was painful for my mom to watch me go through.
You were young. That's the thing. You're young. Like you weren't, you know, in your mid 40s when this happened. You were like just out of grad school. You were just starting your first big real job.
Yeah.
Ugh. You were in New York at the time and your mom was able to be there with you?
Yes, thank goodness. She was there the entire time. I recovered at my godparents' apartment because that was in the city and it was an elevator and not a walk up. So that was super fortunate. And she stayed with me for 2.5 months.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's really good. So she was it because you couldn't fucking do anything.
No. At first, I mean, even when we got back from the hospital, things like I couldn't lift a glass of water. I couldn't touch the back of my head. I couldn't open the refrigerator door. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't take a shower by myself. Anything that pulled on, everything pulls on your central core. And so
yeah,
everything
true.
That pulled
every move.
Hurt. Everything hurt.
Oh my God.
I couldn't sleep. I was at a medical lift chair, one of those things with a little remote that stands you up and lies you down. But I couldn't
so you
even
felt like
lie
an old
down.
Person.
Yeah. But those things are awesome, by the way. In that position, it was exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what you were talking about before with this, like our heartbeats, that is what kicked in. It kicked in a little bit immediately in the sense that once I started cardiac rehab, I became aware that my heart was felt like it was beating really loud, really strongly. But I was able to sort of just put up with it because I was so concentrated for the whole first year on this physical recovery. That was, you know, that was my only goal. That was my only job. But then after the physical recovery was kind of complete, you know, quote unquote, the heartbeat continued to stay strong every single beat, 24/7. And then that started messing with my head. And it's actually been that way ever since. It'll be 4 years in 2 months right now. And my heartbeat is as strong as ever. And I have a very love-hate relationship with it. And I have still not come to terms with being able to hear it every beat.
Yeah. So
sorry,
this
not
is something
hear
where
it, feel it. It's
feel
the
it.
Feeling.
But it probably feels like you can hear it.
Yes, it does.
You know? So this is something where it really is a paradox because having a strong, healthy heartbeat is such an example of how far you've come and how well you're doing. But at the same time, it's just a constant reminder that your heart is in your chest and that you went through this and that, I don't know, that you have something synthetic living inside of you.
Right. Exactly. Like I shout at it all the time. I'm like, you know, shut up and stop, which of course, you know, that's not what I want it to do, but it's that sensation of being constantly aware of it. And even knowing that my rational brain completely knows strong heartbeat is good, I'm recovered, it's not a threat, whatever. But it's not the rational brain that's responding, it's the emotional brain, it's the lizard brain that's like, oh, our heartbeat's really strong, we're freaking out, so we should probably tell the brain to pump up the freak out chemicals, so let's just keep that going. And it's like a feedback loop.
That's fascinating. And so difficult. You know, I notice on your Twitter that sometimes you'll talk about breathing activities or like PTSD treatment, kind of anxiety treatment. Is that really about this uncomfortable experience that you have, kind of being aware of your heartbeat all the time?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So when I sort of felt like I'd kind of done the physical stuff and the mental stuff sort of all came flying out of the corner of my brain. You know, at first I tried some talk therapy, and that helped a little, but it really became clear that it was the sensation of the heartbeat that was driving my struggles. And so I have a very good friend who's a GP. He's a family friend that I've known for my whole life. And he said to try either clinical hypnosis or biofeedback. And I'd heard of biofeedback and had been intrigued by it before. So I tried that first and happened to find a doctor who did it and told her my story. She said, I think this is totally something that will help you. And so I think that was at least 2 years ago, around 2 years ago now, started that.
And and tell me if I'm like probing too much, but for anybody who hasn't had biofeedback, I've seen lab setups of biofeedback before, and I know it's, you know, different case by case and depending on the equipment that they have available. Is yours about, like, what is your feedback? Is it about looking at an EKG? Is it about a bright light? Like, explain maybe for people who are listening how it works that you get this feedback loop and it helps you sort of, I don't know, control some of these physiological experiences.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, so like you said, I think that there's multiple types of biofeedback. So my specific one was based on heart rate variability. Mm-hmm. Because what also another cool science thing I learned is just that, and it makes total sense, you know, your heart's a big muscle and it doesn't beat as a solid body. It beats like in a wave. But it turns out that there's three dominant frequencies of your heartbeat that can be broken down and, sort of like I think it might even be like some sort of Fourier analysis where if the highest frequency is dominating, then that's kind of indicative of your busy brain, your freaking out kind of thing. Basically, your sympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, kind
so
of your
that's the thing.
Your in fight or flight mode.
Exactly.
At that point.
So this whole thing is based on it's kind of toning your vagus nerve. Controlling your sympathetic and your parasympathetic. And so instead of trying to dampen your sympathetic response, this was trying to strengthen my parasympathetic response. So not trying to shut down the lizard brain, like letting it do its thing, but then letting the rest of the body just be like, okay, we're disregarding this because we're filtering it. We know that we don't need to be freaking out. And so when I was in the office, I would have a pulse monitor on my index finger, and I would have a respiratory monitor just strapped around my ribs, just below my chest. And I would do breathing exercises that were no different than just a long inhale and a long exhale with a timing that felt comfortable for me. So there was no, you know, magic formula. It was more just what feels comfortable. How many breaths a minute? And so we figured that out. And then it went in stages. At first, I would sort of just stare at a picture and just try and kind of empty my mind, you know, shut down the running stream of consciousness. And then as we would go, she would stop and point out what my heart rate was doing with my respiratory rate when they were like fighting each other.
Interesting.
But over on the left side, she had three bars that were showing the highest frequency component, the middle frequency component, and the lowest. And she would always point out that the middle frequency is the one that we want to go up. And so once I got really proficient at it, in the sense of mostly just practiced and getting my brain to recognize that when I breathe like this, the busy brain part goes down. There were a couple times where she was like, okay, now don't look at all this other stuff. Just look at the middle bar and make it go up. And I would
Isn't
freak
that
out.
Crazy? You're like a monk.
I would be like, what did I just do? I have superpowers.
It's insane how we really can cut through and connect to certain, what we think of as physiological capabilities that are totally outside of our volitional control, but just with the right technology to be able to get that feedback mechanism, that you can actually start sort of controlling them.
Yeah, it was tremendous, and it was a huge. And also, I feel like the biofeedback also worked for me because I was a scientist. Like I needed that data in a way to almost get my other side of my brain to be like, okay, we know what's happening. We're on the same page. The emotional side's on the same page with the rational side.
It seems like it works well for people who do well with like very concrete physical feedback too. Like I've definitely heard of biofeedback for people with like really severe ADHD where, you know, whatever measurement is being taken with regards to EEG or brainwaves, or I'm not really sure how they specifically are taking the measurements of kind of attention. But having a, you know, something as simple as it's a light and it gets really, really bright when you're not paying attention and kind of hurts your eyes, and getting it down to a focused little point of light when you are paying really good attention. It's just having that physical piece of feedback to be, because you forget. It's that's the weird thing about what we think of as being, what's the word I'm looking for? I keep saying volitional, which is kind of an over
involuntary.
Exactly. Voluntary. Thank you. Like these things that we think of as being fully involuntary, we forget that we can control them, but there's a reason they're involuntary. You're supposed to forget about them because they would take up too much processing power if you didn't.
Yeah, exactly. And so what my takeaway from all of this is I would go once a week, but every day I would also do, I just have an app where you can set the same timing that we set in the office. And I do the breathing exercises on my own for 20 minutes twice a day.
Ugh, it's so cool. You can do it on your iPhone. I'm freaking out.
Yeah, but it became really, I mean, it became strong. I was strongly aware of the fact that I need to do it twice a day because when I let it slack, I feel the repercussions. I'm just, it's not that the heartbeat ever physically gets weaker. Mm-hmm. It's just my reaction to it, my stress level, it kind of anxiety in a sense. And I think a lot of what also helped with the biofeedback was the realization. This doctor helped me realize that another reason why this was freaking me out, just besides the fact that you don't normally hear your heartbeat, was because I had experienced the surgery as trauma, in the sense that you normally expect your body to tell you that something's wrong. So you have pain. So you go do something with the doctor and maybe it involves more pain, but it's in the purpose of making that original pain go away.
Whereas, it's negative feedback. It's not punishment. Yeah, you do it because you know if you don't, the pain will get worse.
Yeah. So I literally walked into the OR. That's another freaky thing. I feel like they should not have done that to me. I walked into the OR and climbed on the operating table myself.
Like, no, you didn't.
I did.
That's so fucking weird. They're supposed wheel you in and you're supposed to already be like all crazy and groggy. No,
yeah.
At least that's how it is in the movies. I don't know. I've never had surgery.
I almost think that might have helped, just because it like sets the tone, like, you know, that you're sick. So we're going to carry you in and we're going to make you better. Whereas it's just like, oh, climb on up.
I know. Cause then you can see the tray of equipment and I don't know. You're not supposed to see any of that.
Yeah, I think I don't know. I didn't really see much because I did, you know, end up horizontal pretty fast. But
yeah, that's good.
But either way, yeah, it was basically I went from no pain to the worst pain of my entire life. And, you know, I think also like a lot of all of the heartbeat is like this memory. It's like these flashbacks of all of that pain and trauma and just the fact that, you know, also it's amazing technology that we can go inside someone's body and fix their heart. But at the same time, like, I definitely feel this sense of having been violated because like people were inside my body doing things.
This is something that I've never had surgery. I've never even had general anesthesia. I actually have a pretty big, I wouldn't call it a phobia, but like a pretty big fear around general anesthesia. The idea of basically taking somebody to the brink of death so that they are unconscious during surgery is scary to me. The more you read about it, the more you're like, wow, I don't want to have to ever do that. But odds are in your life, you are going to do it. And we talk about surgery as if it's such a, yeah, so-and-so got sick, they had surgery, they're better. Or, yeah, you know, I broke this thing, I had to get surgery. We don't often talk about the psychological ramifications of going under the knife. It's a very invasive procedure. It's a procedure in which you are made to lose consciousness in a way that you never do throughout your life except in that state. And yes, you are fully entrusting people who you don't know to actually, like the term you used, violate your body in a way. Although they are there to heal, you have to trust that they are skilled. You have to trust that they are going to make the decisions that are best for you in the 11th hour. And you have to do it all while you aren't at the wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is that my heart was stopped for 3 hours or so.
Wow.
Like it was not beating.
So how do they do that? They have your blood being like flown through you with a machine?
Yeah, the heart-lung bypass machine.
Okay. I'm freaking out because I'm like of two minds. Like part of me is really empathetic and it's like, wow, my God, I can't imagine the experience because of my own weird fears. And another part of me is looking at you like a total lab rat. And I'm like, that's fascinating.
It was pretty cool. I will send you the link. I had one of the OR nurses take pictures during my surgery.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Like I said, the scientist in me really was interested in what was happening. And so you can see how much the heart deflates without any blood in it.
Wow.
It goes like a pancake.
And that must be another, you know, component to some of the things that you deal with in the aftermath is this, again, this paradox of like being such a scientist and being interested, but also knowing that like you are not a specimen, you are not a lab mouse, you are yourself, and you have to deal with the ramifications of that. Like even today, probably looking at those photos is simultaneously fascinating and anxiety inducing.
Yeah, no, it definitely is both. Because one of the big things that I still sort of on my agenda is I want to get to the bottom of why my heartbeat now is so strong and loud, because it's not medically, there's nothing medically wrong with it. My blood pressure's fine. Everything is fine. It's not that it's not pumping too fast. My pulse is fine. It's literally just there's some sort of impulse force or something that's happening. And the scientist in me wants to know. But every time I need to get in a certain mindset where I feel like I'm in a really good place with the biofeedback before I can start down that road, because otherwise you're right. It becomes its own trigger.
No, yeah. And that's like some full on Newton shit, like sticking, you know, sticks in your eyes to figure out what happens there. Like there is, interestingly, as scientists and science communicators, there's a long history of self-experimentation and self-reflection to try to understand biological processes, physical processes. You can consent to things that you can't always, you know, get other people to consent to. And also you have legal authority to think about yourself in a way, to push yourself in a way that you might not necessarily be able to do in the landscape now. You know, back in the day, a scientist could get their hands on pretty much anything to do an experiment. It's not like that anymore.
Right.
So
yeah,
there is an impulse. Yeah, there's this impulse to like want to learn more about yourself, but you do get into that uncharted territory of like, is this physically dangerous? Okay, even if it's not physically dangerous, is it psychologically dangerous? I love the point you made earlier when you said, I know that I have to do these breathing exercises twice a day, because if I don't, I feel the effects of not doing it. And I think that that resonated with me as somebody who deals with mental health issues. And I would not be surprised if it resonated with many of the listeners, this feeling of like, now that I found the meds that I need, or now that I have the talk therapy, you know, with the right therapist in the right frequency, you start to find these mechanisms in place that really help you cope and help you live with the mental illness, because of course you're not curing it, you're dealing with it. And you feel it when you have to change your schedule. You feel it when you accidentally skip 2 days of meds because you're out of town, or when you have to cancel 3 weeks in a row with your shrink and you can't make it. There's a real tangible effect of that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because it's a hard thing for other people who don't have any of those experiences to understand, especially when sometimes a tiny slip in your self-care shows itself as a large slip to the outside world, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily, what's the word? Proportional sometimes.
Yeah, and they don't get it. It's like, oh, you forgot to take one pill, or you didn't get to talk with this dude for an hour, or you didn't like breathe real deep for 20 minutes. Like, how could that possibly affect you in this way?
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes I'll
lose. One of the things that happened recently is that I'll lose an entire day out of nowhere if there's some sort of incident that happens, whether it's a conversation with somebody or it's hard to like cite a specific, but
a trigger
of sorts, like whether it's, you know, assholes on the internet or or an actual trigger related to my surgery or something, but something that causes like this spike in adrenaline for anger or for surprise or for something like that. And for me, it's like a long, long curve of it coming back down. So like I can't calm down in an hour. Like it takes me like 4 or 5 hours to calm down. And so out of nowhere, I can just lose an entire afternoon. It drives me nuts.
It's so frustrating. You know, it's a burden that a lot of people bear, a lot of individuals who know what it's like to struggle with mental health issues. I have to say, and this is like probably no consolation to you whatsoever, but I'm going to say it anyway. I feel like when these sorts of terrible things happen, it's for me, a silver lining being your friend and being somebody who looks up to the work that you do is that it happened to somebody with such insight and somebody with such ability to communicate experiences, communicate scientific information surrounding those experiences, that it becomes so much more than a personal experience. And it becomes this beautiful teaching moment and this beautiful moment for connecting to individuals who maybe have never been where you've been and who can maybe through reading your blog or through listening to the words that you say, get a glimpse of understanding into a friend or a loved one's experience.
Oh, thanks, Cara.
And thank you, Summer. All right, guys, as you may have noticed, there were some just a few audio issues in this week's episode. That's what happens sometimes when we record remotely. Some data gets lost. It's a huge bummer, but I guess that just means I have to hang out with Summer again and record a part two. I had originally asked her her answers to the two questions, but there are just so many issues with the file that it would not be pleasurable for your ears to hear all the choppiness that got recorded. So before we say goodbye, I do want to thank Summer again for joining me, and I want to go ahead and give a shout out to all of the cool work she's doing. You can find her on Twitter at Summer_Ash. You can also find the work that she does with the astronomy outreach at Columbia at Columbia Astro. And of course, you can find some fabulous fashion at Startorialist, where they do an amazing job highlighting and featuring really great stellar, astronomical, nebular clothing and accessories and things like that, just to celebrate all of our loves of science and space. And guys, I want to thank you. I mean, like I always do every week, for coming back week after week and supporting the show. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.